Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Monday, join us for a personal tour of Who's Reading the Organon, a show hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook. She invites you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts as we complete reading Samuel Hahnemann's Organon. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community. Each Monday, I take some time out in the day to begin with some inspiration to talk about current events and read the words of Dr. Samuel Hahnemann in his Organon of Medicine. Today is February 28th, 2011, and you're listening to show number 134. Thank you all for joining me today. Today, we are going to have a special guest, Dr. Manfred Mueller, but I also want to remind everyone that what we talk about on the show is just a study session, educational and learning. If you're interested in your personal health care, you need to find your health care provider and speak with them about your situation. And I'd also like to tell you that when you get on Blog Talk Radio, we have so many options for you to click to listen, to friend to the show, to say this is your favorite show, or to comment. There is the live chat. You can get on and post your questions right now while we're on live. And you can become a friend on Twitter or share this show with your Twitter friends or on Facebook. You can listen to all the older shows on the clicking the archives and download them to your computer, your iTunes, or your iPod. So we have a lot to learn today from Dr. Mueller, Manfred, and I don't have my huge introduction that I did for you the last time, and so maybe you can introduce yourself today, the president of NASH.
Yes, thank you, Debbie. Yes, I am president of my second term as president of the North American Society of Homeopaths. I am a homeopathic consultant in private practice, and I have been for the past nearly 30 years. And I've also been a consultant for the program on integrative medicine, where I've been giving lectures there and presenting cured cases and so forth.
At UNC Hospital?
At the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, actually, in the integrative medicine, they have a alternative medicine class there where medical mm-hmm. students can actually learn about various healing modalities that are considered complementary and alternative to the conventional form of medicine.
Mm-hmm. So they're sort of, UNC is on the leading edge of that. I'm sure that not all hospitals or teaching hospitals have this available to their medical students or staff. So I'm very, very pleased that you have been able to do that kind of work with them.
Yes.
Why don't I give a little inspirational quote from Sir John Weir, physician to King George VI. It says, quote, "I believe what prevents men from accepting the homeopathic principles is ignorance, but ignorance is criminal when human lives are at stake." And I would like to also bring to the attention of the listeners that Dana Ullman has recently posted a brand new article on the Huffington Post, a really well-read online newspaper, is almost as big as the New York Times, and he's talked about the royal family and how homeopathy has been in use for centuries, many generations in the royal family, and how they have promoted it in their country. And now that there is another wave of skepticism vying for the attention of the economics and the financial resources of the country, homeopathy is once again under attack. However, if people would just recognize the potential and the healing benefits of homeopathy, I think that the people will be clamoring to keep it on. It does not cost hardly as much as conventional drugs and conventional treatments. So we're going to be talking specifically today about mercury and toxicity. And I also want to thank the sponsor of our show, Roger Van Zandvoort, for really believing in Homeopathy World Community. And if you want to take a look at his Complete Dynamics computer repertory, which was just updated this week, I just downloaded the brand new update at www.completedynamics.com. You can take a quick tour and read the documentation behind the program and even just download the free browser edition. It's a fabulous program. Okay. We're going to go ahead and learn about mercury toxicity and how we approach that using homeopathy and just getting a little bit deeper understanding of the mercury that is in our environment and how we are touched by it or affected by it in our daily lives. So just as a general beginning question, Manfred, we do have mercury in our environment in some places, and also it's of great concern to me that children can be in their developing years can be affected by mercury toxicity. Can you just touch upon that just a little bit?
Well, yes, mercury is a Can you hear me? Yeah, okay. It's a toxic substance. It's very toxic. It can be absorbed into the body. When it is absorbed into the tissue, it kills cells. Mercury goes into all tissues of the body. It travels very quickly. Mercury is a very special heavy metal in that it's very toxic metal in that it's special in that its boiling point is relatively low, and so at room temperature, mercury is a liquid, and of course it can also vaporize quickly when it gets warmer, and also under other circumstances. Studies have found that mercury is highly toxic. There's hundreds of studies on the health effects of mercury, showing that it can cause a wide variety of disorders, and certainly children are at risk from that substance. And wherever mercury is, it should be carefully controlled. And of course, you mentioned that this is a widespread problem. So there's mercury from industry. There's mercury from we mentioned in our show last time. There's mercury from vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
There's small amounts of mercury preservatives in many vaccines, and there has, of course, been efforts for more than 10 years to try to remove those. But apparently, vaccine makers have insisted on using that preservative in many adult vaccines. And I understand several states have moved to outlaw children's and vaccines for pregnant women that contain thimerosal, which is a mercury product.
Right. So this, what, whenever I think of the word mercury, I remember in the eighth grade playing with mercury in our hands. The boys would shoot it across their desk.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you were in that day and age, but it was something just to be amazed at, the qualities and characteristics of being able to hold in your hand a liquid metal that at room temperature, you know, it wasn't solid. Now, we think about lead and zinc and other kinds of metals as being completely solid, and you can't move it around or at room temperature. And we know that lead is definitely a toxin, and that's why the FDA has removed it from all paints, and children who are in old buildings who peel it off and do put it in their mouths, they can get very bad toxic neurological effects from it. And in the same way, we have mercury that is in our fish. These heavy metals have gone into and polluted our oceans, and now pregnant women and just in general, you will hear on alternative medicine sites not to be eating fish that are the large fish that consume and accumulate all of the heavy metals and toxins from the oceans. So these are things that people need to be aware of. And I suppose there are still people out there who have not heard about the detrimental effects of mercury in their environment. I'm also questioning, there are our new light bulbs, which I really love, the fluorescent light bulbs that are pure sunlight, and they have a very small amount of mercury. And we need to know how to take care of these bulbs properly and not let the mercury out in that way. And I'm also concerned or wondering whether the mercury from those light bulbs are staying in there or whether when the light's turned on, it gets emitted into the room and into the air. And are we breathing it then? We also have mercury in our amalgams, in the metal in our mouth. I grew up and had tons and tons of fillings put in for cavities, and a lot of people are having them removed. So, I mean, there are lots of places in our environment, in our bodies, that it can accumulate. So now, do you feel that mercury needs to be dealt with in addition to ordinary homeopathic treatment, because as a homeopath, you provide acute care, chronic care for all ages, children and teens and adults, men and women, the elderly, all types of people can use homeopathic treatment. So I'm basically would like to know if there's a special thing that you do when you find out people are being affected by mercury.
Yes. Actually, this is also a good question for homeopaths themselves. Many homeopaths don't actually do anything separate. They think all we need to do as homeopaths is remind people of, you know, take their case, take their symptoms, and then find a remedy for them, and the remedy will take care of it. Well, it does not take care of mercury-induced diseases, and in fact, sometimes even aggravates them and causes additional problems depending on what the circumstances are. Mercury-induced disorders are very complex, and even in the 19th century, homeopaths were aware of this problem because in the 19th century, medicine, conventional allopathic medicine, used a lot of mercury in their treatments. And so when you study the homeopathic texts from the 19th century, also our Materia Medicus and repertories, you will find references to abuse of mercury. Abuse of mercury meant, or was referring to, the medical use of mercury. Homeopaths felt this was an abuse. They felt that people were getting very sick from and recognized the dangers of iatrogenic-induced diseases produced by mercury. And they were trying to figure out the solutions for them. Mercury was used, for example, in the treatment of syphilis. So homeopaths developed means to remove the mercury. Some of them were very crude, but some of them are still very helpful.
Okay.
So yes, homeopathy by itself doesn't remove mercury, but it can antidote the symptoms of mercury temporarily, and it can help with the symptoms a great deal even during detoxification for mercury, but the detoxification still has to happen, as well as the removal of the cause.
Mm-hmm. So can you give us a little bit more information about the iatrogenic disease? And when you say they used it for treating syphilis, did that cause, in homeopathic terms, a miasmic layer for individuals or generations of people? I know it's kind of an advanced question for beginners.
Well, yes. Mercury caused, literally mercury toxicity. It caused a poisoning by mercury, and it is known now that the so-called third stage of syphilis was actually a mercury-induced problem. The mental illness associated with syphilis does not come from the disease, from the microbe. It actually comes from mercury, and you mm-hmm. don't see it anymore nowadays because, of course, syphilis is treated differently today. But the point is, even in other illnesses where mercury was used, eventually psychosis developed, which is one of the mercury-induced problems. But there are numerous other health problems that are induced by mercury. And when I said iatrogenic, that also would include the modern-day iatrogenesis. Iatrogenesis means the doctor-induced. So when you talk about vaccines, for example, containing mercury, and there's no doubt, Geyer and Geyer, two researchers, have done studies that show clearly that there is a relationship between certain childhood diseases and mercury, the very mercury that is contained as a preservative in vaccines. So mercury is a serious problem, and yes, homeopaths do need to recognize that that needs to be taken care of or addressed. If they don't want to take care of it, then other people need to do. Conventional physicians are not educated in how to treat mercury-related problems. Fortunately, some physicians have started to look into it, like Dr. Dietrich Klinghardt, who has become almost like an expert in mercury detoxification. And we can learn a lot from his work.
Thank you very much. You'll give me the spelling of his name.
Klinghardt, K-L-I-N-G-H-A-R-D-T. Dietrich is the first name, D-I-E-T. R-I-C-H.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Klinghardt is an MD, PhD, educated medical scholar who is from Germany. He is has a thriving practice, and he has a website. You can probably find it by Googling his name.
Sure. Okay. Now, it's very, very interesting. I don't know whether there's a relationship, but I was on a website the other day where somebody was talking about helping with Alzheimer's disease, and they've discovered some new drug for help, you know, adding to the wide variety of drugs that they already are giving these individuals who have lost their mind, who don't remember anything, or are having the effects of Alzheimer's, and they're going to give them another drug. And I kind of got all upset and wrote a little response in the comment saying we need to detox these people. We need not to add a further burden into their body system. And so does the mercury contribute to the Alzheimer's as well?
Yes, it does. Doctors Kasdorf and Walker wrote a book called The Toxic Metal Syndrome, where they cited numerous scientific articles that show a connection between mercury and Alzheimer's. Of course, Alzheimer's also has been related to aluminum poisoning, another metal that can be very toxic. But in my view, clinically, I think far more people are suffering from mercury poisoning who get Alzheimer's, and mercury can simply by itself induce that disease.
So it's, you know, I keep going back to my childhood and the idea of touching that metal in my hand for a week while we were studying it, and also the thermometers we used to have had mercury in them because of the barometric properties that it has to be very sensitive to temperatures, which is one of the symptoms for someone who has some kind of mercury poisoning, and sweating and taking on and off their shawl, or all of these worse at night and things like that. So for those, I keep going back to my memory, and maybe other people also can do that. Would I be affected on a long-term basis from my childhood from being in contact with this metal?
Yes, you can be, although I did want to mention just pure mercury, the liquid mercury as you see it in a thermometer, that mercury by itself is not as toxic as the mercury salts. What happens is when mercury combines with other materials, which also sometimes happens within the body, once you observe mercury, that is actually the real toxic mercury. So the mercury salts are far more toxic than pure mercury, the element mercury. Recently there was a case of a janitor, I think it was in a Durham high school, He was playing with mercury and showed some of the kids the mercury, and they, and several children were actually touching it and playing with it for quite a long time, and may have inhaled it and so forth. Some of them may have gotten sick. In other words, this became a big issue. I think the health department got involved, and the kids were tested at the hospital there. And if they didn't find mercury in them, which is by itself actually kind of surprising, because all they were saying there was that they were doing urine analysis, urine tests, and blood tests. And of course, urine tests and blood tests do not show up mercury, even if there is a toxic problem. And we can talk about a little bit more about that later.
Okay.
So to find out whether you have mercury is not as easy as it sounds. It's not just a matter of doing a urine test and a blood test, because mercury goes into the tissue and does not get circulated in the body. But if you have absorbed mercury into the body, it is a problem, because it goes very, very rapidly into the various tissues, including the organs, and can cause damage wherever it goes.
And that would be long-term damage. That, you know, it might not show up immediately. It might take a while, maybe some years, for the accumulated amount of toxic mercury to actually show. And when you say the mercury salts, you're talking about mercury that has been manipulated in a lab to be impregnated in certain products?
No, more or less in the body, mercury can combine with other substances like chloride, fluoride, and numerous other substances that are already in the body. And for example, there's a warning that mercury, that's methyl mercury, it's far more toxic than ordinary mercury. And methyl mercury can be produced by taking vitamin B12. So experts are warning not to take more than 100 micrograms per day of vitamin B12 in order to prevent, if you have mercury in your body, in order to prevent mercury to combine with cobalamin and turn into methylmercury.
That is very important information for people to know.
Mm-hmm.
So if they detox and get the mercury out, then it's taking their vitamin B12, which is really important also, will be less of a problem. Okay. So we're understanding that mercury is a dangerous toxin in our environment. When we get it into our body, it changes form and becomes even more toxic to our tissues. And what exactly happens to the body?
Well, the mercury goes into the cells, such as, first of all, studies have shown that it goes into all cells of the body. That means it can go anywhere. And actually, it does go everywhere. And it travels around the body fairly rapidly. So, for example, during studies, they found that the mercury will show up in vital organs like the kidneys, lungs, the spinal cord, and even the brain within 2 weeks of placing amalgam dental fillings. And so within 2 weeks, a person can show symptoms, if they are, especially if they're particularly sensitive. Most people, however, don't show symptoms. They won't even show symptoms for maybe years or even decades after they absorb the mercury. And even though they continue to absorb more mercury, they still don't show symptoms, because the body finds ways to deal with the mercury. And one way that has been discovered by Dr. Klinghardt and his team is it will utilize microbes such as yeast cultures, bacterial cultures, even viral and fungal cultures, to hide the mercury and protect the cells from it. So you may develop a chronic infection someplace, and the infection is full of mercury, because the mercury hides in the nucleus of the cell, the infectious cell. In a way, the body voluntarily stands down and stops defending itself against this particular microbe and allows it to grow in order to store the mercury in the body. So this is one of the mechanisms the body protects itself against mercury, but it's a compromise. And instead of mercury poisoning, you get chronic infection.
Wow. So it's almost like how cancer works and encapsulates itself to try
yes.
and save itself from spreading and metastasizing. So the mercury, it's the body is has its own innate wisdom that this is not
That's
a good
right.
thing. It doesn't. It's not good for the body, and it finds ways to protect itself. And yet, we can be aware of them if we listen to our inner self and become aware of the symptoms, the minor that changes from a normal, healthy state to a disordered state, whether it's emotional upset or chronic infections, as you're saying. And to take antibiotics to further suppress the body is not going to help this problem. We need to really do the detox.
Yes.
And I'm just learning about that now. Do you think we've covered all of the information as to why mercury is such a dangerous toxin, or is there any further information?
Well, I'd like to support some of what I'm saying with scientific studies. So, for example, Dr. Murray Vimy and Fritz Lorscheider at the University of Calgary in Canada have conducted studies to see whether mercury actually does go from the amalgam fillings into the body. And with regard to what they found, the way they did this study was they labeled the mercury in the dental fillings. They placed it in the mouths of sheep and monkeys, and they labeled it with radioisotopes, which can be followed with X-ray. So they X-rayed the animals subsequently after placing amalgam fillings. And they traced the mercury via the radioisotopes, and they found that within 2 weeks it had moved from the fillings into the vital organs, like I said, kidneys, lungs, liver, spinal cord, and even the brain. So that's how we know that there's not been really much of a question that mercury is dangerous. Everyone knows that. It's a highly toxic substance. It will kill every cell it gets in touch with or it enters. It will kill the cell. So if it gets into nerve cells, it will produce lesions in the areas where it is, and it will kill cells. It can cause paralysis and cause all kinds of health problems. But the body is able to deal with it and is able to protect itself against it.
Mm. So you were saying that it does travel very rapidly, and it goes to the vital organs of our body, the lungs, and the spinal cord, where you're saying this is a little bit of an explanation of why we would have paralysis and nerve
damage.
Yes,
and MS, for example, is a disease that's been associated with mercury. And mercury needs to be removed from MS patients because before they can heal, the cause has to be removed. As you know, Hahnemann laid this down as a basic principle of treatment, that you cannot treat the disease or should not treat the disease before you have removed the cause. And, of course, in this case, if the cause is mercury, the mercury must be removed.
Hmm. Oh, so we're going to learn a little bit about that, but do you have any further scientific studies that you wanted to mention?
No, that's it.
Okay, and we talked about the disorders, which were things like MS and Alzheimer's.
Yeah, but numerous other, not just neurological disorders have been linked to mercury, but also heart disease. In fact, mercury can ruin the heart arteries and cause plaque in the arteries. Liver diseases, kidney diseases. Mercury has been associated with chronic kidney disease, nephritis. And mercury can also induce, because when it's in the cell, the immune system no longer recognizes the cell properly and begins to attack the cell. So autoimmune diseases have been linked to mercury, the presence of mercury in cells, and like rheumatoid arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall cases. One time I spoke with a woman who was hoping to get homeopathic treatment for rheumatoid arthritis, and after speaking to her about the mercury issue, she decided to have all her, in her case, all her teeth pulled because she had terribly bad teeth, and there were huge fillings in her teeth. And she had more than, I think she had 18 or so fillings. and she decided to have them all removed. She never needed homeopathic treatment.
Just by clearing
all her,
it.
All her symptoms disappeared, and she was perfectly fine.
So this is one of the principles that Hahnemann states, right?
Yes.
That if you remove the cause, whether it's the fact that, like scurvy, you're not getting your vitamin C, if you provide what's needed, or if there's something in your environment that's causing you to have physical effects, and if you just remove that, then you don't need further treatment.
Yes.
So,
well, if your symptoms disappear, that's by no means guaranteed. In her case, it worked out. But there are many people who, because they already have absorbed substantial amounts of mercury into the body, that just removing the fillings is not sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll still have to go through a detoxification program to actually remove the mercury. And during that program, a lot of people benefit from homeopathic treatment as far as their symptoms are concerned.
Okay, can you explain that a little bit further? People benefit
because
homeopathic treatment?
Well, because many people have symptoms, and the homeopathic treatment will be able to antidote the effects of the mercury, so it will take away the symptoms.
Okay, so in other words, if a homeopath is treating someone constitutionally or for some flare-ups, and they don't really even recognize that it's due to this mercury toxicity because they're treating the person holistically and recognizing their symptoms, that they will be dealing with some of the mercury toxicity along the way?
No. What will happen is the symptoms recede as a result of the homeopathic treatment. So, for example, if you have swollen joints, painful joints, in case of arthritis, with homeopathic treatment, those symptoms will go away. And the homeopath who is not aware of the mercury issue will hope to eventually see a permanent cure, a receding of these symptoms, like it should happen if there's no sustaining cause. However, because there's an internal invisible cause, those symptoms will come back. 3 years later, this patient will be back and complaining of the same symptoms, and that's because the cause has never been removed.
Well, is this the way Hahnemann himself thought, in terms of he had the same type of problem and that's how he came upon the miasmic theory?
No, the miasmic theory is actually a much misunderstood issue. I don't know if you want to get involved in that. That's a very complex subject. But just briefly, Hahnemann thought of miasm simply as infectious diseases.
Okay.
He understood that people had infections that were chronic and that caused all kinds of chronic illnesses. This is how Hahnemann's understanding of miasm was. It was other homeopaths after Hahnemann who interpreted his theory slightly differently. And much of the subsequent interpretation is still in the homeopathic belief system. And so, for example, the idea that people need to be treated for certain miasmic taints, that has come out of Kent, largely out of Kent's, Herring's and Kent's work. And Kent was one of the people who, in his book, Lectures on Homeopathic Philosophy, mentioned the miasmic effect that is an energetic effect. And he looked at it largely as an energetic effect that would have to be corrected in order to fully cure chronic illnesses.
Okay. Well, that probably could be a show in itself.
Yes.
To understand this much, much further, and the level of understanding one would have to have. So let me just go back in where we were to say that if there is this invisible internal sustaining cause, the person is going to keep relapsing.
That's
unless
correct.
They detox. And so the homeopath or alternative care practitioner or even their physician understands that there is an abundance of mercury in the body, which we can't tell through your analysis or blood analysis, is if I'm understanding you properly, but we will be able to tell by other means, then we would have to go through your treatment process to remove the mercury as best as we can. And we talked about the sources of mercury. I don't think we need to go back into that. unless you think that we missed one of the sources.
Well, there are many sources outside of that. You mentioned the fish. I became aware of the problem of mercury in the early 90s and began to warn my clients about the health effects from them, and including warning them that fish was potentially contaminated. And this is because I read articles and also got direct research from the EPA that indicated here in North Carolina, they discovered that many river fish were completely contaminated. There was an article in a News and Observer in the mid-90s that showed that fish had were absorbing mercury from the groundwater. And they were wondering, you know, the EPA was examining the sources of the groundwater, and they found that hazardous waste dumps contained mercury because the mercury was transported in sealed containers to hazardous waste dumps. Eventually, they began to leak and leaked into the groundwater and eventually poisoned the rivers and, as a result, poisoned the fish. Interestingly enough, that article mentioned, as if obligatory, its last sentence was, however, mercury amalgam fillings do not appear to be toxic, which I thought was almost laughable. Of course, the American Dental Association has refused to admit that mercury fillings are toxic. They are highly toxic. And 0.33 micrograms of mercury per day evaporates from a filling, and a person absorbed that much from that filling per day, which is 33 times the maximum OSHA allowable limit for mercury. So it is highly toxic. If you've got 10 fillings, that's 300 times the OSHA allowable limit. So people are getting sick from this. There's no question about it.
Right. I think I even put a video on Homeopathy World Community showing the vapors coming off of the amalgams with, you know, special photographic techniques. And if I find that, I'll let the folks know about it. We can search the HWC network for that. And truly, if we're actually putting the mercury directly into the body, into the mouth, into the internal soft tissue and the nerves, touching the nerves of our teeth, the dentum, oh my goodness, how can they deny it? It just doesn't make sense. I do feel as if most of the dentists are switching over to composites, but I may be completely wrong on that.
Well, there's finally some movement in there's enough research. Senator Burton, or maybe he's a representative of Indiana, has held hearings and has shown that the thimerosal from vaccines is harmful. They've had experts from all over the world testifying, and this information has gotten out now. I think the issue just can no longer be hidden. In Europe and in many states, and in California, I don't think any dentist places amalgam fillings anymore. 50% of the amalgam filling is mercury, and a lot of people call them silver fillings, thinking that they're made out of silver. They're not silver. They're mostly mercury. There's a little silver in them, but they're not silver fillings. They're mercury fillings. So we do need to remove them. It is the largest cause of mercury chronic mercury poisoning is the amalgam fillings. Then the thimerosal and vaccines, and then the fish. Those are the most common causes. There's still a lot of medications, and even contact lens solution that contains thimerosal. Some medications contain it, and they can contain other forms of mercury. So anything that has MER in it should be considered contains mercury.
M-A-R.
M-E-R. The
M-E-R.
M-E-R. Wherever the MER appears, you will have a mercury in the name.
We shall be on the lookout.
Yes, and it's always a good idea before taking any medication to check and see that there's no mercury in it. You'll be surprised if you look up what's in medications. Most of the medication is, of course, the active ingredient, but there are often other ingredients, some of which are toxic and harmful, that you're taking along with it. So I have found that some medications contain MSG, and MSG-sensitive patients may have a problem with those. Also, aspartame and a number of other harmful ingredients have been found in medications.
And they use a lot of other words for aspartame, don't they? So that you don't really know you're getting it.
That's right. They keep coming up with new ways of hiding it.
They try to hide, but they can't hide. It will eventually come out, and people will feel the effects.
Evidently, yeah.
So we are now aware. I'm wondering, is there mercury from industrial plants that go into the atmosphere?
Yes, there is. Mercury is used in many industrial processes, including electronics, soldering, for example. They use a mix of mercury in the solder, and
yes.
That's why there are OSHA regulations that they have to install ventilation systems. As I mentioned before, dentists put amalgam scrap into hazardous waste containers where it has to be carefully transported. I believe it has to be underwater so as to prevent evaporation, and has to be in a sealed container. And dentist offices now, many dentists are installing ventilation systems that, in order to prevent them from exposing.
Right.
I've always found it interesting that dentists have a very high suicide rate, even though dentists make a good living, but they're at risk themselves.
Risk
themselves from this terrible poison, and it does affect the nervous system. And I know of at least two articles published in peer-reviewed psychiatric journals that link depression and anxiety to mercury.
Okay. And so if you see the your dentist's hands shaking and him looking very sad,
<That's right. laughs>
you know there's something wrong. And I really seriously would be concerned if I was a dentist with the statistical rate of illness for dentists in their office of not only the mercury, the amalgam, but x-rays. I mean, there are a lot of things to be concerned about in
yes.
the dentist's office. Okay, those are other topics. So how much mercury do we absorb from dental fillings again? You already told us that. It was a lot.
0.33 micrograms per filling per day.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and that is over a lifetime?
yes, unless you do something about it.
Because
for as long as you keep your teeth. if they get pulled, then you no longer have to worry about how much you absorbed, but you still have to worry about what you have absorbed.
Yeah, okay. So for us folks who are getting into our later years, in my sixth decade of life, and we did, it was just sort of like you just go to the dentist and get drilled.
That's right.
By the way,
periodontal disease, like gum disease, is related to mercury also. A lot of people find when they have their amalgams replaced, they no longer have gum disease.
Wow.
The Foundation for Toxic-Free Dentistry conducted several studies on amalgam removal, and they found that hundreds of patients who had their amalgams removed, many of their health problems and symptoms disappeared within 6 months of the removal. And, of course, those that don't disappear can still be disappeared, because that's without even detoxification. There are methods of detoxification that are very helpful, in addition to, of course, homeopathic treatment, where homeopathic treatment can help with the symptoms while the detoxification is going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, if someone wanted to have their amalgam fillings taken out, and that they have to have them replaced, I know it's going to cost a pretty penny. What specifically do they need to know?
Well, for one thing, each replacement can trigger an immune reaction, some chronic illnesses that is relevant. So it has to be carefully done. First of all, the removal itself has to be expertly done. It should be done by a dentist who is thoroughly familiar with the safety techniques, such as placing a rubber dam around the tooth that they're working on, so as to not expose the patient to unnecessary mercury shavings or drill dust from drilling it out. Then
right.
also proper ventilation and irrigation should be used. So again, be very careful not to absorb mercury during the removal.
So they need to find somebody who's done a lot of this and who is especially trained
yes.
in mercury removal.
That's
right.
correct. And all okay. dentists should know this, but the safety is very important. But the second thing, that's something that most dentists don't know, and that is that the immune reaction. Hal Huggins was a dentist who early on became aware of this problem and actually went to school and became an immunologist too. And he noticed the issue and tried to solve it with various protocols. And the Karolinska Institute in Sweden looked into the issue and came up with protocols. Klinghardt looked into it, and over the years, looking at all of these protocols and working with thousands of clients who were choosing to have their amalgams removed and replaced, and getting their feedback, I have come to a protocol that works for people and does not cause any adverse reaction. That is, you can remove as many fillings or replace. It's actually the removal that causes the immune reaction. But you can do mm-hmm. as many of these fillings as you want within a 2-week period, but then you need to stop for at least 2 to 3 months before you have any more removed. So people who have a lot of fillings, they can have, you know, maybe several sessions in the first 2 weeks and have a few of their fillings removed and then or replaced. And then they should wait before they do any further. Because if you don't, then the immune reactions double up. You may have two immune reactions, and they become overwhelming. And especially if you have any immune disorders, that can cause severe adverse reactions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So
that's one thing that should be kept in mind, and that's something that that unfortunately you are going to have to tell your dentist because often dentists do not know this.
Right. They're not aware of the scheduling that's necessary.
That's right. You
in
have
order
to, make
to prevent.
Correct. Mm-hmm. You have to make the schedule yourself. You have to say, I can't come back for another 2.5 months.
Right.
I've seen this to be very important in diseases like MS, like rheumatoid arthritis and other illnesses.
Okay. And is there any special thing that a patient who is going in for this kind of removal, besides scheduling, making sure they're not eating fish? I mean, what other types of questions might a patient have typically asking you about, you know, they probably are very unsure of what is safe to do and what is not safe to do, what, dietarily or otherwise. Like,
well,
what about people who clench their teeth and grind their teeth at night? Things
right.
like that.
Which is a mercury symptom, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
That is a symptom. And, of course, you can't solve all of these problems at once. This is a process. It takes a while to remove the mercury and from the body once even the fillings have been removed. But some of the questions they would be asking is, does it hurt? That's one of the first questions.
Good question.
For most fillings, it does not hurt. It is, and many of my clients went to dentists and asked the dentist not to use any anesthetics for shallow fillings. There's really no pain.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, most dentists will recommend still to do the anesthetic, the local anesthesia. But in most cases, that's not needed.
Mm-hmm. So it is important. We want to state that it is important to have your teeth checked, have them cleaned regularly, clean them yourself regularly. And would you say biannually to have an X-ray to see if there is further decay? And
no, absolutely not. I don't think X-ray is a good idea at all.
Okay.
To every X-ray exposes you to some radiation unnecessarily. And most dental situations do not require x-rays. Obviously, you haven't had one for 5 to 10 years or so and go to a new dentist. That dentist is going to ask for an x-ray. But if you had recent x-rays, there's no need for an x-ray.
What about the fact that I recently had digital x-ray? So it's not the same. I don't think it's the same.
Yeah, well, it doesn't matter, but it's still an x-ray. You still have exposure to unnecessary radiation. And so according to Dr. John Goffman, probably one of the experts on the health effects of x-rays, even one x-ray can give you cancer.
If it's the one that tips the scale.
That's right. And that depends on whether you have certain hereditary predispositions and so forth, but it can trigger an oncogene, and it can trigger the effect that will ultimately lead to cancer. So, and I know dentists will downplay that, but the fact is, don't do x-rays unless it's absolutely necessary.
Okay. I will take your word for it. Now, what
That's my
about...
opinion.
It is your opinion. It is.
That's right.
And I agree with you as a survivor. Now, what about if you have cavities and they can probe and feel that there's soft tissue there, or that the pick sticks in there and you know that there is decay, you do recommend to have a composite filling, or is there something else that will strengthen our teeth, especially, I don't want to get into the fluoride thing. That's a
whole
other...
Well, the dental issues, those have to be decided by dentists. In other words, some people have large fillings that are, once they're removed, they will leave a very unstable tooth, and it will have to be restored through crowns and so forth. So all of that should be taken into considerations, and decisions need to be made on an individual basis with your dentist that you have... what happens after the amalgam replacement, that's a dental issue. It's a technical issue that needs to be resolved beforehand and discussed with you beforehand. And some people then, of course, will ask a question, what kind of crowns, what kind of materials can I have? What about the crowns and their materials? Porcelain crowns have been found very safe. Not a lot of people have problems with those. But there are some highly sensitive people who sometimes react to materials in crowns, too. And I've seen people react to metals such as gold. Even though gold is considered an inert substance, some people are still sensitive to metals, as you very well know from... From people who wear jewelry. Some people have earrings and they react and get a rash from the I've seen it with pure gold, 24 karat gold. you still see allergies.
I think in the Materia Medica or in the repertory you can look up sensitive to gold, and I think arsenicum is one of the remedies for that. So it's not something brand new. People for a long time have been sensitive to different substances in their environment.
Right, and experts who are experts in mercury have pointed out that once you have mercury in your system, you very rapidly will become sensitive to all kinds of other metals.
Wow.
So this is also related to the mercury issue.
Okay, so we really have to study up ourselves. We can't depend on someone else to give us this information. We have to get out there and do some research, and especially if we have an autoimmune disease or something, it's up to the individual to actually find out more about their disease from every different type of research that's out there. What do we have to do to remove the mercury? We have to go and make sure we find an expert who has done hundreds, if not thousands, of these removals using the proper equipment, the proper ventilation, a dam so that it doesn't go down the back of your throat or you're not inhaling the dust or the vapors. And do we have to, like, prepare physically for this?
No, it's not necessary, although some people recommend to take some chlorella, which can absorb some of the excess mercury before the dental sessions. and that's probably helpful. And then also in some cases, a homeopathic remedy may be helpful. People sometimes are scared of dental sessions. The remedy gelsemium has been very helpful in terms of helping them with the anticipatory anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that is a wonderful remedy. It's
also
great for influenza, too.
Yes. Also, in spite of the precautions, sometimes people do get some symptoms. They're usually mild after the dental removal. And some of them are related to the anesthetic. And some of them are simply immune responses. And I found heparasulfurous calcareum as one of the best remedies in a low potency, especially low decimal, low X potency. And also sometimes arnica. If teeth become sensitive after work on them and the sensitivity remains for more than a day or two, then certain remedies are helpful, like staphysagria, nux vomica, lachesis, and so forth, depending on what the symptoms are.
Right. People need to know that homeopathic treatment is individualized to the person's disorder and symptoms that they're expressing at the time. And we
just overall, in general, I would say that it would be very worthwhile to have an expert, not just about the dentist, but also have an expert to work with you throughout the whole process of the mercury detoxification.
It would definitely be confirming and helpful to have that support system to know that if you have so many questions, and it sounds like a person would have a lot of questions, that someone would be able to answer them and assist them through that process. And how long does it take to remove all of the mercury from the body, especially for folks who have a mouthful of old amalgams?
Yeah, even with the best detoxification protocols, and the best ones are the ones that go slow. Slow meaning that you don't try to do too much at any one time, because it's always associated with adverse effects. And this is the case especially with so-called IV chelation methods. I found numerous casualties from that method, and I personally can't see how anybody would want to take the risks, unless, of course, there was a need for instant action because someone is dying from a disease and they're really trying to do a heroic effort to try to remove the mercury. That's extremely rare, though, and I can't tell you about what the outcome of those situations are anyway. But the thousands or so clients I have worked with, and I provide them with the best expert information, constantly doing research on this subject, and I'm in touch and read a lot of the researchers' information that they've put out. It is the best thing to do is to move slowly, to allow the body to deal with the changes that take place, because remember, the body's already made an immune compromise and has set up protective mechanisms against the mercury, and now it's going to have to alter that setup and change it as the mercury is being pulled out. And some of the most effective methods of mercury chelation has been a combination of chelation of mercury as well as absorption of mercury. And some of the early pioneers in that area were Professor Omura in Tokyo, who has worked with victims of so-called Minamata disease. Minamata disease was a disease that scientists could not figure out the cause of for a long time, eventually figured out it was simply mercury poisoning. Mm-hmm. And in trying to recover the health of these people, Dr. Mura found that the substance cilantro was extremely valuable. Cilantro turned out to be the first substance that was capable of chelating mercury in the central nervous system. So it's very, very relevant for patients of Parkinson's disease, which, by the way, is also related to mercury, Alzheimer's disease, autism, schizophrenia. There's numerous other illnesses that are probably OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder, numerous conditions like Tourette's syndrome, many, many unknown neurological symptoms and disorders of unknown cause are actually caused by mercury.
Mm-hmm. Because you explained that earlier. that we can't see it in the urine analysis or the blood test that we're doing. So
ordinary
are not
tests
aware.
They don't suffice. So how do you find out that mercury is there? Well, they use challenge tests. So they use a mini chelation, either with the MPS, which is another chelator, cilantro, and even chlorella, which is a one cellular, it's an organism, it's an algae that is specially grown for this purpose, and it is non-toxic and contains a protein that's able to absorb mercury.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, the reason why fish get very highly toxic in mercury is because their muscles, the protein in the meat of the fish is capable of absorbing an enormous amount of mercury. It's very absorbent for mercury. So tuna, for example, is full of mercury because that particular protein is there. Coming back to the
And tuna fish is everybody's favorite fish. Tuna sandwich, tuna salad. It's,
yes.
And here we are now in our
should not
older...
eat that because it's very very it's full of mercury and it's you absorb a lot of mercury from that.
Okay, we have some comments in the live chat on Blog Talk Radio. I don't know, maybe somebody can tell me how many people are here. There it looks like a whole slew of people. Victor is telling us that a Hungarian invention that is widely used in Hungary and later used by NASA and other institutions is SomatoInfra, which is an imaging system which projects the heat evolved from the human body, infrared emission.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've heard about that. And there's a high-resolution computer screen. It's
yes.
a great advantage, he says, that it is capable of examining almost the entire body and is also applied for the use of plexus search and for diagnosing certain deviations of the breast, venous circulation disorders of the surface, joint deviations, peripheral circulatory disorders, and specific pain syndromes or tumorous diseases. The examination is quick. It only takes 10 to 15 minutes and completely painless. So that's something I have not heard of. There are no risks, he says, in undertaking the exam, and the results are used for many possibilities. Thank you, Victor.
Very good information, yes. Go ahead.
Okay. Way back when you were talking about other things that we are in our products, aspartame, Marilyn tells us aspartame is also linked to brain tumors. And and people probably will tell you so many anecdotes about they've had their amalgams removed and then they're how much better they feel just from that. But then we need to go to the second stage and do the in-depth removal as you're explaining to us of this chelation therapy, but not via the IV, but using the nutrients like chlorella. And I know on the Homeopathy World community, I've put up a cilantro pesto, which has got olive oil, garlic, lemon, and cilantro. And you just whip it, and you whip it up in your food processor, and you just eat it as a side dish. It's delicious and it helps. But go ahead.
It's not. There's no standard. Again, that needs to be done individualized. Each person is different. And having worked with thousands of people, I've discovered that a significant percentage, perhaps as many as half of people who attempt to detox from mercury run into problems. And those problems are sometimes profound. So especially if they're already suffering from a chronic illness, they should work with an expert. There is no specific standard form of detoxification for mercury. Each
mm-hmm.
person has different reactions and different responses, and they need to be dealt with when they happen. Otherwise, you can cause health damage as a result of the mercury detoxification. So I know there's a lot of people selling products out there, and they say, take this, take that, and this will do it, and all that. This is not how it works. Each individual person should be carefully monitored. There should be testing. There should be response to symptoms. So there should be someone there to interpret the symptoms, understand what's going on. So, for example, when you get an exacerbation of symptoms, it may be that you have chelated too much, you have absorbed too little, the body has not been able to excrete the mercury, and so forth. All of this needs needs to be carefully handled. Otherwise, the symptoms can lead to new illnesses. So, for example, if you chelate too much and don't absorb enough and excrete enough, the chelated mercury will go elsewhere in the body and then may be redistributed to new organ systems where there is not yet a mechanism to protect against the mercury. And so all of these things need to be taken into consideration.
Okay, so I'm listening very carefully to what you just said. And here I am making a cilantro pesto as just a food, just to eat it, and because it's tasty.
Yes.
Not specifically.
Not realizing that some people may get sick from it, and it's a fact. As a matter of fact, one client, after having their amalgams removed, was unable to go to a Mexican restaurant and eat any of their food because it contained cilantro. He had no idea why. He got anxiety attacks, had to leave the restaurant and wait for the panic attack to go away. Mm-hmm. These people usually end up in doctor's offices and they're just diagnosed with some condition and given some kind of suppressive treatment to subdue the symptoms, but nobody tells them that it's really coming from the mercury, the inadvertent mercury detoxification that goes on, or actually mobilization of the mercury that goes on as a result of the cilantro.
Okay. So far, I think I'm good. I don't think I'm having any panic or anxiety attacks, and I don't eat it on a daily basis. But I've been warned.
Yes, I've heard of people who suddenly could not eat at all anymore. All food caused symptoms suddenly. Then people who had severe exacerbation of their existing symptoms. I know of one gentleman who was paralyzed, a young man who was paralyzed, who went to an IV chelation because he went to a naturopathic physician up north somewhere and who identified the mercury problem properly. I think he moved after that, and anyway, or went to an IV chelation process, and within, I think, 2 days of trying this, lost all bowel control, and urine. He could no longer hold his urine. Sphincter was paralyzed.
Wow.
Regained control over these muscles until he came to a consultation with me, where I reminded him that he was exposed to too much mercury at that time. He tried a homeopathic remedy and regained control of both stool and urine.
Excellent.
In other words, antidoting the effects of the mercury.
Mm-hmm. And we have in our repertorization, in the Materia Medica, we can, as homeopaths, search for remedies that are specifically helpful for particular allergens or sensitivities. So we have those kinds of resources at our disposal, whereas regular physicians, I don't know what they would do or where they would go.
Well, he was under care of regular physicians. He was at Mayo Clinic. All they did is, first of all, is do extensive studies. They knew everything about him. This went on for 5 years. He was diagnosed with dystonia. They were giving him a medication which caused side effects and did not work, did not give him any relief of his symptoms. He lost all of the functions, could no longer move his arms, could no longer eat himself, had to be fed, was in a wheelchair, and so forth.
It sounds bad.
And you know, this is considered of unknown cause.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody looks into mercury. The naturopathic physician was the first person who looked into the mercury issue.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to give a plug to Laurel Chaitin.
Okay.
Because she is an award-winning movie producer, and she herself had dystonia. And until she went to Dr. Luke DeShepherd for homeopathic treatment, she had a lot of disabilities in order to perform and do her creative artwork. And now I do want to ask people to support her in her efforts to create and finish 2 years' worth of work to make a movie about homeopathy and its curative or health benefits. So there is a link on HWC. There's a banner on the front page to see about her work. And I just thought of that because you mentioned dystonia, and who knows whether she was affected by mercury. I know that she's doing a lot of work on investigation into autism.
Mm-hmm. Which okay. is definitely related to mercury. No question about it.
Okay. So have we covered the issue of side effects from the mercury detoxification
I think
thoroughly?
So. Yes.
Okay.
And I did want to say, your earlier question, you asked how long does it take. Yes, it takes a minimum of 3 years of continuous detoxification. That means daily. And if the mercury has already entered the nervous system, it will take 4 to 5 years.
Okay. So it
so in
is
case of,
a
like,
long
let's say, if you have OCD and you're concerned about mercury, no, that means... don't waste time. Start. You know, get going with the detoxification program, and do it for the next 5 years.
Okay, so that's why you say you have to pace yourself, take your time. It's
that's
a
right.
slow process. It's
you don't want to. You don't want to risk making your situation worse as a result
mm-hmm.
of it. Sometimes you have to take very, very, very small amounts, and you have to change what you can use. Some people can. Use, let's say, apple pectin rather than cilantro. They're different specific substances that affect people in different ways. And use the ones that are appropriate. And then you find maybe a year later you can go back to the cilantro and it works fine.
Mm-hmm. Because your body is clearing and changing and
correct.
Able to your body is able to adapt. We
That's
must
right.
Impress upon people that the body naturally heals itself, just what you said at the beginning of the show, that it finds ways to preserve itself, to survive, to continue to live and perform the best it can within its circumstances, and it does heal. So think positively that no matter what has had an impression on your body, on your physical, emotional, mental self, there are methods to help you. And just be patient that it takes many years, especially if it's chronic disease. And you are going to tell us how we can find out or where we can find out more about detoxification. I know you have some clinics and classes. And let us know more about that.
Well, yeah, our tutorials that we do for professionals, most of our students are professional homeopathic practitioners around the world, and you can either attend the tutorial or you can purchase our recordings, the CDs that are available on our website, thehomeopathiccollege.org, or you can call us directly at our phone number, 828-626-4093.
Okay, I'll repeat that for them. It's www.thehomeopathiccollege.org. And that's where you're going to be able to find Manfred Mueller, who has been working with this issue. Did you say 30 years? And
I've been in practice, homeopathic practice, for nearly 30 years, and I've worked with this issue for approximately 20 years now.
Mm-hmm. And so you have a lot of wisdom and experience from your thousands of patients, and that the ones who are coming to you now are going to get the best treatment. And I know I really appreciate that you've come on to the show today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Oh, really? Do you have more time to talk?
Sure.
Let me see if there's any. We have some questions coming in here.
Okay.
Dr. Bob, that's my husband, Robert Brook, of North Carolina State University, who is a professor of environmental science, phytopathologist, and he says fossil fuel coal burning is depositing 400,000 tons of methyl mercury into our environmental United States annually. He says, stop burning coal and future generations will not have the problem. And I don't know whether anybody has taken a look at what I put on the front page of Homeopathy World Community last night. And that is three short movies about the gas leaks. And those have got widespread impact on our environment about toxifying or causing pollution in the groundwater of the United States in the areas where they're doing this pipelines. And, of course, everybody knows about the Gulf of Mexico. There's all sorts of pollutant gaseous compositions that are floating around. And people are sensitized to it, and they don't even realize what's happening to them. Catalin has asked on the show, where and how can we find experts in this detoxification process? Well, obviously, Manfred is the best, and then I suppose his students. So maybe, Manfred, you can answer that further.
Well, I'd be happy to work with you if you give me a call. If that's not, if you're looking for someone locally, we can may be able to assist you in finding someone in your area.
Okay, I think Catalin can contact you directly.
Yes, and we've also worked with several dentists who are knowledgeable in this issue. As I said before, not everyone is.
Right, you do need to find somebody who can properly remove your amalgams. And do it over the correct scheduled time. So now, I don't know, if you don't mind, we can talk about homeopathy as being a gentle and effective system of medicine.
Okay.
With long-lasting permanent cure. We're actually being brave. We're going to say the word C, the C word, and that doesn't mean cancer. It means cure, because people are afraid to say that word. And you have actually found that there is a long-term amelioration of symptoms for many of your patients. You want to make a comment?
Well, yes. The beginnings of homeopathy had to do with Dr. Hahnemann's dissatisfaction with the approach in medicine that aimed at subduing symptoms. And he was looking for a genuinely curative approach in order to resolve chronic, especially chronic, but also acute illnesses. Obviously, in acute illness, you have a special situation. Either the body heals itself or it does not. If it does not, then you die. That's essentially the issue of cure. Although sometimes in acute, if you don't die, it can turn into chronic illness. But in a chronic illness, the nature of a chronic illness is the body sustains itself with symptoms usually and within a disorder indefinitely until it finally succumbs to either this or another disorder. And that can take years and sometimes decades. In conventional medicine, most medications are aimed, for chronic illnesses, are aimed at alleviating symptoms. And this is done by giving medications that inhibit vital processes. The homeopathic approach is quite different. In the homeopathic approach, the medicine stimulates a change in the organism and stimulates the self-restorative or self-reparative mechanisms that the body already has, but apparently that are failing to repair the body and bring it back to health. So we're talking about something quite different here. Hahnemann explained, and this is pretty much still the case today, that when you give medicinal substances, you can give them in two ways. One way is to suppress symptoms, and that is done by finding a substance that can produce the opposite symptoms of what the patient already has. In other words, something that will counteract the disease process, or if you want to put it in modern language, something that will inhibit the functions that the body has already is already engaging in the illness. Let me give you an example. Inflammation is a part of illness. The inflammatory process can be inhibited with medication, such as steroid.
Yeah.
And steroids will shut down that process, but they will not solve the cause of the underlying cause of the inflammation. And so the homeopathic approach tries to look at the whole system and tries to find, and it works quite opposite from the conventional approach. It looks for something that can, rather than produce opposite effects, can produce similar effects. So
right.
by giving a small amount of a substance that produces similar effects, it appears from experiment that the body can be stimulated in repairing existing circumstances, conditions, and restore them back to normal or to health.
I love the words that you used, repair and restore. This is really what we need to do in our spiritual self, in our mental thinking process, and the use of the opposite. And everybody's familiar with the anti-inflammatory, antihistamine, antidepressant. The word is right there in the label of the regular drugs, whereas homeopathy, using this minimum dose, which is a major process that homeopaths use, just to, you know, you could even say inoculate. I mean, we know that vaccinations come from the principle of homeopathy of giving a like in order to cure the symptoms. Inflammation today, all physicians, I think, are speaking about inflammation as being a core part of almost every disease.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's now looked into even with heart disease, whether heart disease may be at the core of inflammation may be at the core of that problem. And
yeah,
then
so
of course with cancer too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, they're trying to find more and more anti-inflammatories to be used,
right,
which, as you say, is going to continue to suppress and not really deal with what's going on, the natural curative efforts of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, as homeopaths, treat the patient as a whole and not just the disease.
Yes, homeopaths will select a medicine or substance from the homeopathic Materia Medica that has been proven to, when in crude form given to test subjects, it produced inflammation in this case. So let's say if you have a choice of several of them, you would of course compare the two, and each of them is slightly different. Each medicine is specific with regard to the symptoms it can produce. And produce when you use them in crude form on test subjects. And those symptoms have been carefully recorded. And then that database is used to come up with a medicine that matches the individual's symptom picture. That's in a nutshell what a homeopath then does. When a patient takes that, the body apparently responds to this dose or several doses by initiating a reparative or restorative process, which then ends up eradicating the existing chronic illness over time. And this is done over a duration of time. And there are studies that support these observations, clinical observations, homeopathy. So, for example, in the 1980s, a study was done on rheumatoid arthritis that found some 82%, I believe, of patients had substantial alleviation of symptoms as a result of whatever medicine they were given. And even in cancer, there are studies. In West Bengal, a few years ago, mice were fed with a remedy called carcinosin, which was made from a cancerous tumor. And the researchers found with daily doses of mice that had induced liver tumors in those mice artificially by giving them a mixture of phenobarbital and it's a dye, a yellow dye, p-aminodiazobenzene, and that causes liver tumors, liver cancer, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
These regular doses of carcinosinum, the remedy carcinosinum, activated all of the known anti-tumor effects in the body, and in many of the mice, the tumors began to recede.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the control group, all of the mice died from the liver tumors. So we know that the homeopathic dosing over time can alleviate, in some cases, even cure many serious chronic diseases.
It's fabulous. Now, the thing is, we need to have these types of studies and research projects repeated over and over again, and maybe the traditional medical system will take a closer look at it, because if we have these types of tools at our disposal, these kinds of homeopathic remedies that can really help in so many cases, we really need to be using them. The only one that appears to be recognized overall is, you ask anybody, they know Arnica. But that is just one of thousands of remedies that we can use for healing people. And we also know that homeopathic remedies are gentle, they're non-toxic, they're harmless and safe, and they typically don't have any side effects unless you're going to be repeating it over and over again when you don't need to, which would cause a proving. And that's why you always need to have a professional homeopath guiding you and taking care of you to manage what's going on with your symptoms and your disease. So also, we are, you know, repeating this over and over again, but we understand that giving crude drugs lowers the immune system, lowers the body's resistance to further onslaught from other types of impacts and diseases or sensitivities to their environment. But homeopathic, like things like antibiotics, for instance, you take it for one thing and you end up with a yeast infection.
That's right. They shift the immune system in a different direction. And
or you get, everybody gets upset stomach or something, right?
Many people do get symptoms, yes.
But with homeopathic treatment, we're, like you said, I love the words restore and help support the body's immune system and immune functioning. And it can shift it into a better direction, even though sometimes you might have a health crisis, a kind of a crisis, a change in your health during your treatment.
Yes.
Also, we mentioned that homeopathy is very friendly and can be used for people of all ages, pregnant women, newborns, children going through teething stages and anticipation in exams at school and improving your relationships. Also with teens and the change of life during pregnancy, as I said, or middle age, menopause, the elderly, all different stages of life cycles. Homeopathy has been used and even has groups of remedies that homeopaths are aware of that address these particular stages of life.
Yes, one of the things that I've come across over the years, one of the problems in medicine is that some people cannot take conventional drugs. They simply get too many adverse effects from them and may even have no effect at all and none of the therapeutic effect from the drug. So there is no other options for those people than to look into alternatives. And one of the alternatives that works very well for highly sensitive people like that is homeopathy, because homeopathy only deals with minute doses. It doesn't have anything that people are allergic to usually. And also, the homeopathic theory requires that the dose be adjusted to the individual. So each individual has a different level of sensitivity. Homeopathy can deal with that. There's no standard dose for any given disorder. There is, in homeopathy, there's only an individual dose. So these people do very well by giving the appropriate dose. And I've seen, let's say, even in homeopathy, we have a standard dose. So, for example, Hahnemann said the standard dose was a pellet diluted in water, in approximately a half ounce of water, and then given in a few drops under the tongue. That is the standard dose. Well, you find that some people can't take the standard dose without getting symptoms. And so those folks need to take special dilutions. So by making additional dilutions of that dose and giving and testing it, you can find out specifically the dose that this particular person can take.
Right. So we have the ability to listen to the patient very carefully as they journal and keep a diary of what's happening to them. We're really being very good observers, and therefore we can make and fine-tune the adjustment of the dose.
That's right.
And you mentioned the minute. Go ahead.
That's
Go
right.
Ahead.
And you mentioned the term, the minimum dose. That's it. That is the guideline. Minimum dose means the minimum dose, the smallest dose that still causes a restorative or curative action in the body and that does not cause any adverse effects.
And
that
that's
is
our
the guideline.
And that is our highest goal. That's
Correct.
What we want to strive to do, find
yeah.
that minimum dose. And with the dynamic interaction between the patient and the professional homeopath, then that information can be communicated as
yes.
what the person needs. And that's why there's a close relationship there. As opposed to, I mean, I think if I go to the doctor and they say, what are you allergic to? And I say, penicillin or erythromycin, I'd get really, really sick. They just give you a dose of medication that's put in a tablet or a capsule or something, and that based on your weight and not on your sensitivity, or not it hasn't even been tested on the correct age. Like, so they might have tested something, a drug, on a male, but they're giving it to a female, or they're giving it to an adult when they've only tested on a child, or vice versa. So really, they do not have the scientific information at their disposal and the testing that homeopaths are really the true scientists. They really have studied and learned and written down documentation in the Materia Medica, over 200 years worth of information for how a substance works medicinally.
That's right. Of course, also the homeopathic effect has a very different is very different in its nature in terms of dose, and perhaps we should talk a little bit about that, because when you talk about substance, you are talking about with the chemical interaction of that substance with the body. And this is what's used in conventional medicine. Like, a drug produces some kind of interaction on a chemical level with the body. This is not the case with homeopathic medicines. The homeopathic medicines apparently act on a system of receptors that recognize the presence of not so much the substance, but the electromagnetic information of that substance, or you could say the electromagnetic imprint of the substance. And the body is apparently able, or capable, has the facilities to recognize the presence of a substance, which is obvious when you look at allergic reactions. Some people can walk into a room and who are highly sensitive to dog hair, let's say, and start sneezing. Mm-hmm. And having profuse nasal discharge, their eyes burning, and all of the full-scale symptoms, even though they never touched that dog hair.
Right.
There. Their body is so sensitized that whatever little antennas on the cell membrane or wherever they are able to pick up the presence of that substance in the air. And this is the thing we need to understand about homeopathy. The homeopathic remedies are not absorbed into the body. They're not. They don't have interaction with the chemistry of the cell, but they are. The information is picked up somehow by the body, just like some people who are highly sensitive to weather changes can pick mm-hmm. up these changes sometimes days before they happen.
Right.
I remember my mother used to tell me three, four days before it snowed that it's going to snow, and she was right every time. She felt it in her bones. Now, how did she know? Because her body was able to pick up some kind of barometric pressure change or something. The body is very sensitive. It has all kinds of sensors. And I think one of those sensors is the ability to pick up the presence, the nearby presence of a substance. And that
this is
what
fascinating.
This is what homeopathy makes use of. By putting a minute dilution of that substance under the tongue, the body recognizes it and needs to do something about it and kicks in a response. And that response, being very similar to the response needed for the overcoming of the illness, because the substance obviously selected for that purpose, is now able to help the body repair that illness.
Hmm. And that's something that a homeopath may even see happening right before their eyes. When they have the patient in the office and they know what remedy is needed through the selection of the proper similimum, the similar symptoms, and they give the remedy right there to the patient, and immediately the person will say, "I already feel different." So it can happen that quickly.
Yes, it can.
The sensitivity. It doesn't happen every time, but it can often happen. And as you're describing all of the ways that humans are so sensitive, we talk about a sixth sense.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about, you love somebody and you feel that energy, or you hate somebody and you feel that energy. We are really beings that communicate with our environment, with other people, with the plants and the minerals and the animals that are all around us, or, as you say, even seasonally with weather changes. So it's as if we do have sensors, an antenna. I'm just picturing some sort of an insect that has this incredible sensitivity, or even, a snake. When it puts out its tongue, it senses the heat or something in its environment. You can imagine and visualize all the different animals in the world and how they communicate. Whales with the sonar across, I don't know, was it hundreds of miles can talk to each other. And just to think that, we have so many people who are skeptical of homeopathy because they say there's nothing in it or it can't possibly work. But if you just observe nature, there's no explanation for many or true understanding of how these animals and plants are able to manipulate and work in their environment. We're just constantly learning something new.
Yes, I know. Recently I read about the homing instinct of bees, how they somehow are able to orient themselves. And I mean, these things are fascinating when you look into these energies, how subtle energies within the body are part of the internal regulatory mechanism of the body. In other words, it's not just a chemical machine. It's a far more sophisticated system than that. That there is feedback mechanisms that are purely electromagnetic. And, of course, much of this part of the organism has been largely ignored in medical science. I know there have been studies, but they're relatively few. And some of them were done 70, 80 years ago. But they don't seem to have much of an impact on how we look at the human organism. But there's no doubt when you look at Dr. Robert Becker's work, he wrote a book on the effects of electricity on the organism and cross currents, I think it was the title. Fascinating book on how healing can be stimulated, like bone healing and other healing forms of healing can be stimulated with electrical means. And so we're not just talking about a chemical machine, we're talking about a full-scale, highly sophisticated organism that is able to activate its defense mechanisms based on certain circumstances. And of course, that's the level at which homeopathy acts.
It's a beautiful system of medicine. It truly, truly is. And we, you know, we're constantly learning, constantly investigating. And the one of the beautiful parts about homeopathy is it is based on fundamental laws and principles of nature that don't change. So when we hear about drug recalls every other day, it's because those types of drugs are not based on the same principles as homeopathy. So ours has longevity, and it's almost like eternal, that we're continually to learn about it and how to use it. Okay. We still have more time to talk if you wish.
Yes.
I feel like we're just filling 2 hours with great information. And if there's anybody who – we have still a lot of people on the chat. So, okay, here's a good question from Dr. Bob. He's asking if the homeopathic response is an immune response. I think that it's even more than an immune response. Manfred, what do you think?
Well, I mean, it's been shown to be in part immune responses. It's responses on all levels. It's not just in the immune system, but it's also in all other systems. There are responses on all levels. So, for example, on the skin, when they were treatment of burn victims, they found that cantharis taken internally was able to increase the relative healing of those burns. So it cannot be just an immune response, but it utilizes some of the same pathways that the immune system utilizes, in particular with regard to the uptake of signals. So yes, in an immune response, you have a receptor. You have an information transfer. And Hahnemann believed that merely by contagion to a, and of course in those days they did not understand yet what bacteria and viruses were. They had some idea, but they were just on the very, very primitive beginnings of immunology. And he believed that simply by contagion, the body, the organism responded with a defense mechanism, in other words, with symptoms, such as, say, a nasal discharge or cough, developing phlegm, and so forth. Hahnemann believed, and of course he did not have the technology we have today, like microscopes and so forth, to double-check these theories that he had at the time. But he believed that simply contagion was all that was necessary to activate the response, and that our symptoms simply were the results of some kind of magnetic or electromagnetic, as we know today, signal. And there is, unfortunately, not enough work going on that level, but there's no question that immune response also happens on that level. Of course, the other part is the more widely known part, which has to do with how specific antibodies are developed and how they are directly, the information is directly transferred from the existence of viruses and then their DNA, how the body is able to manufacture specific antibodies to that particular germ.
Right, but it does, that doesn't address, you know, when you talk about the immune system in that way, you're talking about the interactions of things that are either visible or tangible.
Correct.
Or something. But homeopathy, when you give this cantharis, let's say, to the burn victim, and they have an emotional response to that, a sexual response or frenzy, or desire to do something with their skin, in that case, the homeopathic cantharis can reach into a much deeper level, into the level of their emotional and mental response to an impact on their system. So I don't know where that relates to the immune function of the human body, but I think that it's so much more. You know, you can change the way that you that people interact within a family unit or within a work situation because you're changing the total energy of that individual. So I don't know how that fits in with immune response.
Well, first of all, immune system is tied in via the nervous system with the emotional and mental functioning of the body, the organism. Psychoneuroimmunology examines those connections. But as I said earlier, the homeopathic response apparently takes place on all levels. I'd like to give an example from science, and one particular science is called toxicology. Obviously, homeopathy deals with toxicology since many of our medicines are made from highly toxic substances. Obviously, toxicology deals with the direct chemical interactions of a poison and the tissue in the organism. But there's another level, and that is the interesting and relevant level to homeopathy. When you look at the effect like hormesis is the observation in toxicology that a minute amount of a poison can stimulate protective mechanisms against that very same actual toxin. So, and this was demonstrated in numerous studies. So, I think Dr. Calabrese from somewhere in New York.
Buffalo? Joey? Is that Buffalo?
No, actually. I can't remember.
Okay.
It's on the tip of my tongue. I can't remember the name of it. But anyway, he's at a university up in New York, and he's collected over 3,000 studies that show the so-called hormetic effect. Hormesis is simply the body's ability to protect itself and also to heal itself in afterwards with minute doses of toxins against the effects of toxins. And perhaps we're looking at the same mechanism here in homeopathy, except for the fact that in the homeopathy, sometimes homeopathy has shown that it's not even just small dilutions that trigger this effect, but and also that this effect is not reserved only to toxins and causatives.
Right.
As we saw in say the mice, they were given a different substance. But for some reason, the carcinogen that I mentioned earlier, the carcinogen which was made from a tumor, triggered a similar effect to counteract the destructive effect that previously a combination of the phenobarbital and the yellow dye had accomplished.
Right.
They'd accomplished with a poison, a particular poison that had caused a liver tumor, and yet a totally different substance was able
right.
to trigger a beneficial, or we could say protective effect and restorative effect. So and those effects were documented. There were these mice were examined with standard biological methodology, and they showed all of these effects took place. But when you look at the substance, first of all, by all ordinary means, carcinosin was given a 200 C potency, which is not a substance actually at all. In fact, scientists are at a loss to even prove that there is anything at all in that medicine. The medicines that have undergone, starting with an actual substance, that material from a breast tumor, that undergone, and that's the other thing, it wasn't even from a liver tumor. It was from a breast tumor. So whatever that substance had undergone this serial dilution and succussion method, which homeopaths call potentization, and propagating some information, apparently, from that original substances beyond, into dilutions way beyond where there is any molecular residue, although maybe there is some there, as some recent studies show. But in any case, so that element is still not clear. What is clear is we can see these effects also with physiological doses. So, for example, when you take sabal ceruleata, and they have done this, they've taken low potencies, meaning like a 1x of, that's a 1 in 10 dilution of saw palmetto extract, and see tumors receding as a result and other tumor markers being affected. In other words, there's no doubt that specific medicinal, and there are numerous studies like that. When you look into the what's generally under medicinal herbs, but most of those are used in homeopathy, and many of them are used in very low dilution, and they found that they have protective effects, many of which cannot be explained how exactly the mechanism works of these protective effects. They trigger protective effects in the organism that say cause apoptosis, which is cell death in tumor cells, and they're specific. So, for example, they found that sabal ceruleata, its action is specific for prostate cancer. That's amazing. Why should it be? But it is. And homeopaths have said this for 200 years. They've used sabal ceruleata in low potencies to people who have prostate enlargement, prostate trouble, and prostate cancer. Now, right. Science has demonstrated that there is such a specific effect.
Right, but you can't patent it, so, you know. there you go with that one. No, but I'm saying they can't patent it, so that's why it's off the radar for them.
actually, some of the researchers, I think, that did the homeopathic studies now have patented it.
Yeah, they're trying to patent our homeopathic remedies, which is crazy. But I wanted to also mention that, you know, you keep talking about these poisons and toxins and how effective they are with different diseases and symptoms and even cancer. But, you know, there are things in the environment that you don't consider to be toxic, like a chickpea.
Right.
Or a marigold. Or just, you know, and they have just as great an effect on healing properties on the body for many very important things. I just read in the New York Times that they said that for wound healing, the best preventative is sanitation and care of the wound and not antibiotics, which is typically used, which then just throws the whole body out of whack. So even scientific researchers today are reviewing and taking a closer look at what's happening by drugging the entire population for every little thing when we have ancient wisdom. Let's take a look at how much time we have left, about 5 minutes. And if there's anything that we want to talk about, we really can cover a lot of area in talking together, man. You know, very much of what we've been talking about is almost like allergic response, allergic disorders, immune dysfunction, disorders and dysfunction, how the body itself has an innate protective mechanism, how it has that working out, and how it will encapsulate something in the body to keep it away from damaging our vital organisms or organs, or we will, you said something in the air, like dog smell, odor, we are sensitive to, and automatically we're going to have a trigger reaction, like people who have hay fever in the spring or in the autumn, to mold. And there's things in the air that we really don't see, but the body is very attuned to.
Right.
So homeopathy is very, very effective at recognizing and taking the symptom picture of the individual to understand what's going on and at least know the best way to select a remedy to treat the entire person.
Yes. And apparently the only contact that is necessary is our senses. Our senses are part of the picture. So even if we only have, in case of olfactory sense, we have been exposed perhaps to one molecule of that substance in the air and experience it via the olfactory sense, apparently simply by having that information, the body can respond to it or will respond to it in some form or another. How this works is still being studied, and of course a large element is understood is immunology, like in case of allergic reactions, have explained how this works. But there's another element that is still being investigated, and that is what role does the electromagnetic fields, what role does electricity in this equation play? One study I thought was very interesting was done by a homeopath in Russia, well, actually in Georgia. His name is George Natarashvili. Natarashvili is perhaps more how you pronounce it. In any case, he's conducted several studies where he looks at the action of homeopathic medicines in various tissues and under the influence of external electromagnetic fields and how it changes the action. That's very fascinating. So the George emailed me and he said, there's no doubt that homeopathic medicines act like electromagnetic fields. As you know, electromagnetic fields are a physical factor that affect the organism. They affect how the cells work. For example, how our brains work. More than 40 years ago, Henry Lai did studies in Washington on the health effects of electromagnetic fields, and he found that melatonin, serotonin, and all kinds of, in this case, neurotransmitters, were affected by the exposure to electromagnetic fields. Calcium metabolism is affected by it. So simply by being exposed to these things, you can be affected. Why should you not be affected by a homeopathic medicine, which is an electromagnetic field?
Well, our time is just about up, and this has been incredible. And you've led us at the last minute into some really fascinating information. I would like to tell my listeners that on Sunday night, I have a midnight meditation because I really believe words are energy. And if you watch a movie, it changes your body, it changes your heart rate and everything else. So if it's just looking at something, if you just look at something and it can change your being, thinking about things and doing meditation can change and reduce your stress. I encourage you to come and listen with me on Sunday night. Manfred, I invite you to also come back. And I think we have another time scheduled. I will inform the listening public about that. And we're going to close the show for today. And it's just been grand. Bye-bye now, everyone.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Who's Reading the Organon with host Debbie Brock on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to take your Organon off the shelf and read it.